Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one, Christy Alligood. Dr. Alligood is a sought-after teacher, speaker, and thought leader whose experience spans the science and practice of behavior analysis. Dr. Alligood received an MA in 2003 from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and a PhD in 2007 from West Virginia University. She is also a doctoral level board certified behavior analysis, BCBAD. For over 10 years, Dr. Alligood has been a behavior scientist at Disney's Animals, Science and Environment. In that capacity, she uses her expertise in the application of behavior analysis to enhance the welfare of non-human animals through cooperative training, environmental enrichment, behavioral problem solving, and behavior change strategies supporting the conservation of wildlife and wild places. Dr. Alligood is a faculty member in the Department of Psychology at the University of Florida and a nominee for the 2021 UF College of Liberal Arts and Sciences Teacher of the Year Award. She has served in many leadership roles in the Association for Behavior Analysis International, including president of the Applied Animal Behavior Special Interest Group, coordinator of the Special Interest Group's board, and at-large representative to the Executive Council. She was also a past president and current secretary of the Southeastern Association for Behavior Analysis. She is an instructor for the Association of Zoos and Aquariums Environmental Enrichment in Zoos and Aquariums course and general member of the AZA Behavior Advisory Group, serving on the Cultural Change Working Group. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Dr. Alligood to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Christy, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
That is quite the bio you have, and I'm excited to dig into your experience and the knowledge from all of the hard work and time you've put into your life's work. So I was wondering, to get started, if you could take us back to where you got started and where you first got into applied behavior analysis and share some stories with us from your journey.
Sure. So so I got interested in behavior analysis way back when I was an undergrad. That was a long time ago. And like a lot of other behavior analysts, I came into the field through working with individuals with developmental disabilities and helping them to succeed behaviorally. And then I studied behavior analysis all through graduate school, through my master's degree and my PhD, in both the laboratory and in applied settings. So basic behavior analysis and applied behavior analysis. And during my doctoral work, I really got interested in applied work with animals. And my time in the animal world really began when I went to work as a research fellow in animal behavior at Disney's Animal Kingdom a little over 13 years ago now. So back then I worked on a captive breeding and reintroduction program for an endangered species. And then I went on to manage one of the science labs and do some different kinds of work over the years, right up until about 6 or 7 years ago when I was embedded within the behavioral husbandry team. And my role really began to focus on working with them to integrate science into meeting animals' behavioral needs. And that includes training and enrichment and, you know, other things as well. In terms of stories, I think, you know, one of the things that really kind of carried over for me from my work in the human world to my work in the animal world was the value of working on an interdisciplinary team. It's really interesting. It's been interesting for me to really see the parallels in that sense between the different kind of areas of work. So back when I worked in the human world or focused more on the human world, I worked in a place called the Center for Excellence in Disabilities in West Virginia. And this is back when I was getting my PhD. I was the behavior analyst trainee on this interdisciplinary team that included a nutritionist, a social worker, a speech pathologist, I'm probably forgetting some, an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, lots of different specialty areas. And it was so great to be able to have that sort of collection of expertise on each case that we saw to really be able to draw from and to collaborate with. And moving into the animal world, when I started working at Animal Kingdom, I also worked and still work on an interdisciplinary team there. And I work with scientists from lots of different backgrounds. And I just think I'm so lucky to be able to draw from all these different areas of expertise in the work that I do. And that's been a real kind of parallel for me. And the other story that I always think of is when we really started doing this science integration work 6 or 7 years ago, what really kicked it off is that Michelle Skirsky, who I work with at Disney, one of the behavioral husbandry managers, was working with an animal care team that was trying to solve a behavior problem. And they'd been trying for a long time with limited success. And she asked me for some information on the science side of the kinds of strategies that they were trying to use and how to make them more effective. And so I put together a few different things for her to read, and a couple of them were like more popular press articles. And then one of them was part of a textbook chapter from kind of the classic applied behavior analysis text, the white book, the Cooper, Herod, and Heward book. And I didn't really expect that one to be the one that resonated the most, but it was. It really hit her that, you know, even though that textbook didn't focus on animals, it focused almost exclusively on people, she immediately saw how applicable it was to the work that we were doing with animals. And that was just such a cool moment, I think, for both of us to really get us started on that work of integrating this scientific evidence that's been developed in other settings into the work that we're doing.
And so working with Michelle Skirsky, and for those listening, you can go back and listen to a previous ATA podcast episode with Michelle Skirsky, a wonderful human being and a wonderful practical applier of the science of ABA and the tools that it provides us. Working in with Michelle and all of the animals at Disney Animal Kingdom, how does your view of ABA applying to everything get influenced by species such as reptiles, snakes, or ones that are, from an ethological perspective, so vastly different to dogs and horses, but also so much alike in so much as they are subject and have, as part of their biology, learning? How do you integrate that into your work, and what have you learned from this process of working with such a diverse range of taxa?
Oh, so much. I've learned so much, and I continue to learn all the time. I think that one of the really cool things is to be able to see those principles of behavior working across all of those species and those taxa, and really seeing too that difference between, you know, when we talk about those ethological differences, you know, it's true that there are certainly differences in sort of the behavioral profiles across different species, right? And then on the other hand, as Susan Friedman likes to say, it's really behavior is a study of one, right? And so, you know, two different reptiles of the same species might have slightly different behavioral profiles and might have different reinforcer preferences. And, you know, it really comes down to that individual and to do that work, you know, across species and across taxa while still seeing the individual applicability of those behavior principles has been really cool.
Can you give us any examples of where you went to work with the humans that are working with the animals? That would be a correct way of saying what you do, isn't it?
Yes.
Rather than going and working with the
Absolutely.
Humans. where you just a challenging one. What has been one of the more challenging projects or individuals, animals that you've had to work with?
Well, you know, I think a lot of times the most challenging situations are the ones where we're trying to change unwanted behaviors. And one of the really useful things to carry over from the body of work in behavior analysis over the past 100 or so years into our work is looking closely at function, the function of the behavior. So not just relying on finding effective reinforcers, although that's very important too, of course, but also matching reinforcers to the reason that the animal is performing the behavior in the first place. So that can really inform our strategies about how to change behavior, how to build new behaviors. So for example, if we're trying to change a behavior and our strategy is to apply timeout in hopes of reducing that behavior, but the function of that behavior is to get away from the situation, we could inadvertently be reinforcing that behavior and making the problem worse. So this is a really key takeaway from the behavior analysis literature to really integrate into training and enrichment, as well as just general behavior problem solving, that we really focus on that function of each behavior.
It's an important thing to remember, and one that I feel like potentially even in the last 12 months I've really kind of got a better understanding on, and I'm excited to know how I feel about this in 12 months from now. I'm continually learning as well. You said before your job is to integrate the science. What is, like, can you explain your role a bit more? What does it mean? I mean,
sure.
From where I'm sitting, it seems like a dream job.
Well, I mean, it seems that way to me too. So, so we have done a lot of work over the past few years at kind of the designing the vision of our program. So I can definitely talk about, you know, the different levels at which we're doing that work. So, so there's, you know, one level is the individual animal level, right? Where I actually work with our behavioral husbandry managers and our animal care teams on strategies for specific animals and helping them to thrive in their environments. And then there's if you move up a level, it's working with an entire team on building their capacity to help their animals thrive in their environments. And then if you move up another level, it's our entire program with all of our animal care teams and our internal education and how we are helping all of those teams to build their collective capacity by learning about behavior principles and learning about how to interpret them to their work. And then one more level up is the industry, right? The zoological industry. So sharing what we're doing and what we've learned at conferences and in professional service and in publications and things like that. So my job includes all of those things and probably more, but those are some kind of general ideas.
Are you seeing many similar roles being created in the zoo industry as yours, or is yours quite unique in what it is?
I think it's pretty unique. I have definitely seen more like curator of behavior type roles, things like that. But I think my sense is that those are more similar to our behavioral husbandry managers roles, where it's oversight over, you know, behavioral programs versus like a scientist working with that program, or even leading that program. So I think that for the time being, it's still pretty unique. Although what I am seeing is a lot of curiosity and openness from animal professionals about behavior analysis and about how that science applies to their work. So I think even without more roles like mine, behavior analysis and the science behind it is finding its way into zoos and behavior programs in zoos.
And do you see, you mentioned earlier, your part of your role is communicating to the rest of the industry, not just within your organization. Do you see need for a more systematic link between the practical applies of the information and what's happening in the lab or what's happening via university and being published in the literature? Is there a gap there?
Yes, I think there is a gap. And this is going to be, we're going to be doing some spoilers for what I would say later about what I would hope for the future. But yes, I think that, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, when Keller Breland and Marion Breland, later Marion Breland Bailey, were students of Skinner's, there was a really close tie between the laboratory, because they had worked in the laboratory, and then the applied work that they did training thousands of animals for commercial purposes, right? And, you know, and then that work ended up moving into the marine mammal industry. I think that somewhere along the line, that link to the laboratory and even to the applied research side was lost or at least diminished somewhat. And I think that it's starting to get picked back up, and I love that, and I hope that that continues.
Yeah, cool. And has that... what you've just said contributed to your new offering that we're wanting to mention today as well, that you're an exciting new offering, and I know there's a lot of excitement about it in our industry, in our community, and that is your collaboration with Behaviour Works and Dr. Susan Friedman's offerings is that what this offering from you, tell us about it, and is that what it is aiming to do, is to close that gap a little bit?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. So this new thing for 2021 is a course that I've been working with Dr. Susan Friedman to develop, and we're launching it under the Behavior Works banner, and it's called How Research Works, and it's really about helping animal professionals to sharpen their skills at understanding and evaluating and interpreting behavioral research that's relevant to what they do. And I definitely see that as connected to this goal of reestablishing those connections between the animal training world and the science of operant learning. And I think, you know, a big part of that is that when I talk about those connections, it's not just connections with what we already know about operant learning. It's a connection with that living, breathing, growing science of operant learning. So that means building both sides of that science and practice community, right? So that means that animal trainers act as informed consumers of research and learn more about how it works and how to evaluate it and decide what it means for them. And then on the other side, researchers conduct practice-inspired research that's relevant specifically to the practical needs of animal trainers. And I can say more about that in my kind of future spiel. But yeah, I think it requires both sides of that. And so the course is definitely, you know, the hope is to help with the animal trainer side of that.
Do you feel that there is a little bit of, this is a loaded question to frame it that way. I'm curious if there's, to borrow from Susan Freeman's, one of her many offerings, beautifully combined words, some cultural fog about what science-based means. We talk about science-based training a lot, and I feel like that's often referred to positive reinforcement, but then I also contemplate if you're not using positive reinforcement, learning's still happening, so therefore you could claim that any work with behavior is science-based training. Do you think there's cultural fog currently in our industry that needs to be, as fog metaphorically is lifted from where we are in 2021?
Definitely. I think that there is some reliance on things that were current in operant learning a while ago, and we have built more on those things on the science side, and it hasn't quite filtered through sometimes to the training community. And I think also when you talk about science-based training and what does that mean, one of the things that we will talk about in the course is evidence-based practice and what does that mean. And when we talk about evidence-based practice, are we talking about like a selection of things that are evidence-based practices, like you said, like positive reinforcement? Or are we talking about a verb? Are we talking about something that we do as professionals that we do evidence-based practice? And that's the side of it that we'll focus on is, you know, what does it mean to treat that as a verb and really bring the best available science to our practical work?
I feel like lots of people are going to be getting excited about this. Just to go back a little bit in your story before we push forward and talk more about this, I have been telling everyone since I spoke to you how inspired I was by your job. I'm just like, do you believe that this person does this thing for a living? And I've been like explaining to them my understanding of what you do. You said before one of your goals is to make sure that you're meeting animals' behavioral needs. In your words, what does that mean for you?
I think that it means a couple of different things. So, you know, we always talk about training and enrichment under behavioral husbandry, right? And so if we think about those two things to begin with, on the training side, meeting behavioral needs means helping animals learn to participate in their own care, right? So that we can give animals choices and have these things be voluntary and, you know, as little stress as possible involved in medical procedures and things like that. So that's one side of it, is that husbandry training and medical training. And then, you know, the other side of it is what animals do all day, right? So when animals are in human care, what are they doing all day? And, you know, we want to give them as many opportunities as we can to not necessarily always engage in behaviors that look exactly like what they would be doing in the wild, but maybe to have some of the same functions and to do a variety of behaviors with those same functions that we would see in the wild. So different ways of foraging, different ways of playing, different ways of moving around their environment, things like that.
That's awesome. Sounds like a very fun environment to work in when those kinds of conversations are happening and those kinds of thoughts are being directed towards what your team are practically applying. For people listening to this who are like, oh my god, like, we're not doing that at our zoo. and obviously resources differ between organizations, although we can be resourceful and figure out ways to do things, what advice do you have to anyone listening to this that works at a zoo that might be charged with behavioural related projects and disseminating information and building capacity, as you said before? What advice do you have to these people who are inspired by what you're saying?
Well, I would say two things. I would say to, you know, learn what you can about behavior and how it works in the natural world. And then I would say to just start where you are. And, you know, we can't go from 0 to 60 immediately, right? Everybody's program is built over time and with different steps in the process. And so, you know, you just start where you are and take a small step and then just take that next small step. You know, and every step in that process, there are complications, right? And there are, we hear a lot from students that we work with in the AZA professional development course on enrichment that sometimes there are challenges with getting buy-in, I guess we could say, from other members of organizations as people become passionate about training and enrichment and moving those programs forward. How do they kind of bring others along with them? And that's not always easy. And like you said, you know, when resources are scarce, it's not always easy to convince leadership to devote resources to new things. And it's just about prioritizing those relationships with your colleagues, with your coworkers, and helping each other and moving one step at a time, you know, towards those goals that you set for your program.
I love it. One approximation at a time. Celebrate approximations, yeah, as Susan Friedman would say.
Absolutely.
If you aren't at the level of wanting to invest in a master's and you might be interested in what you're about to offer our community, Christy, via Behaviour Works, can you tell people where they can go to find out more about this program you mentioned earlier and when it starts? And I know it's going to start very soon after we release this podcast episode, but how can people get registered for that and where do they go to do so?
Yeah, all of the information is available at www.behaviorworks.org. On the left side of the screen, there is a menu, and under professional courses, the name of this course is How Research Works. And all of the information about course objectives, the schedule, CEUs, registration, everything is there. And the first day of the upcoming course is Wednesday, March 24th, which is coming up very soon, but there is still registration available. And this is an 8-week course. For those who are familiar with Living and Learning with Animals, Susan's course, this will be a very similar format in terms of the schedule and in terms of the technology that's used. So there will be a weekly lecture for each of the 8 weeks, and then in between the lectures, there will be a homework each week where students will answer a question and then a teaching assistant will start a dialogue with them about that homework to deepen their understanding of that week's topic. And I'm really fortunate to have three of the excellent Living and Learning with Animals teaching assistants working with me on the How Research Works course. And they are really great at these homework dialogues with students. So in terms of future offerings, we do plan to repeat the course at least once a year, maybe twice a year. And the course was designed for graduates of LLA, but it's not a requirement to have taken LLA before taking this course. We do think that those who have taken LLA will be very well prepared for the course, but we're really excited to get this rolling.
I feel everyone's going to have a positive conditioned emotional response to that format, having been through LLA. I know a lot of our audience have done LLA, so this seems like something you're interested in, go check it out. We will link to it on the show notes for this episode as well. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Christy. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we like to call them. Moving forward, I know myself and a lot of people in our industry are, as mentioned, super excited about this offering, and we're kind of giving them a little bit of a teaser today into some of the things they might learn from you if they were to register. To build on that, you've kindly offered to share with us 5 big misconceptions about how research works. So thank you in advance for thinking through these. Let's dive in with 1.
Sure. So the first one is one that we kind of teased a little bit in our conversation so far, but the misconception is that science is complete. And relevant to animal training, I guess the misconception would be that our knowledge about operant learning is complete, right? And that's really far from accurate. So science is an ongoing process. There's a lot more to learn about the world in general and operant learning in particular. And in fact, in science, when anytime a new discovery is made or some new evidence is gathered, it often leads to lots of new questions for investigation. And a lot of scientists say that that's the mark of a good study, is that it leads to a bunch of new questions. So yeah, that would be the first one, is that there's a lot more to learn.
What would you say some of the biggest questions that potentially the academic community have with regards to operant learning or ancestry, or just ones that you're interested in, or the biggest questions you have in this area?
So there are a lot, and a lot of them have to do with the specifics of the strategies that we use in behavior management and how best to implement them. So one of the ones that I think is really interesting is thinking about what's called treatment integrity. So when we make a behavior plan, and we, you know, we write it out and we say, this is how it's going to go. We're going to deliver reinforcement every time the animal does X. And so they're going to start doing X and stop doing Y. What happens when we start implementing that plan and it doesn't go perfectly, right? Meaning that our implementation doesn't look exactly like the way we planned it, because we're human and we make some mistakes sometimes, right? Maybe sometimes we accidentally deliver a reinforcer for something that we weren't supposed to, or sometimes we aren't fast enough and we don't deliver a reinforcer when we should. So that sort of tie-in between what's planned and then what actually happens is that treatment integrity piece. And there are a lot of questions about that. And there's been some really good work about it, on those questions. And there's work that continues on, which kinds of errors are the most impactful to the results of your behavior plan. And, where to put your focus, when you're thinking about, we're going to be human. It's not going to be perfect. We're not machines. So what do we need to focus the most on, on getting as close to perfect as we can? And what does it look like when we make those mistakes? What is the impact on our outcomes? So that's just one small thing. But there are so many. Another is some of the negative aspects of positive reinforcement. So that sounds really ominous, but there's a line of research in behavior analysis that comes out of the laboratory and has moved into applied settings now on what are called rich to lean transitions. And what that means is when you're transitioning a learner from a strategy or behavior plan where you're delivering really a rich schedule of reinforcement, or really high value reinforcement, or really high magnitude reinforcement, any of those things, right? And you're transitioning from that into a time where maybe the reinforcement isn't going to be delivered so often, or it's going to be slightly lower value or slightly lower magnitude. it's still positive reinforcement, right? Everything's still positive. But that contrast between the rich schedule of reinforcement and the lean schedule of reinforcement is very important, it turns out. And there are some really systematic things that happen when you transition learners from those rich schedules to those lean schedules. And there are some things for us to learn about how to make those transitions go well for us. And yet there are still lots of questions about it too, in different settings as well. So there are lots of examples like that where there are questions about how to implement things in ways that maximize their effectiveness, or how to translate things that we've seen in the laboratory to the settings that we work in. I mean, there are many careers worth of research questions still to be investigated.
Wow, that was exciting. They sound like pieces of content all in their own right to make podcast episodes on. I was too many questions. I can't even talk. I've gone speechless. So I'm curious, I've got my train of thought back. I'm curious, is most of this research being done with human learners? Is these lines
of inquiry? Like the research that I was just talking about?
Yeah, the lines of inquiry that will be followed with those questions, is that with human learners mostly?
Those particular questions, yes. Although the rich to lean transitions literature actually started in the laboratory with animals. So it started with rats and pigeons and then moved into applications with humans. And the way that things have been going so far is sort of that the applied literature has started out mostly with human learners, and then the animal world has kind of picked some of those things up more recently, right? So an example would be functional analysis, right? And using this very systematic procedure to try to figure out why a behavior is happening, and then that helps us to figure out how to change it or how to build it effectively. And that is something that started out in the applied laboratory with human learners and then moved into practical settings with human learners, and then more recently has been used with animals in applied settings as well. So that's kind of the progression typically so far. But I think that as we are able to reestablish or continue reestablishing this connection between animal professionals in practice and researchers in operant learning, that we're going to start to see more of that sort of translational research and that applied research that comes out of that happen in parallel with both human learners and animal learners.
So is that part of your role with Disney is looking at the human learners and the work being done with them and applying it to non-human learners? Are you doing that? Are you kind of taking that information to your team?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is a rich, rich literature of things that have a really robust evidence base in behavior analysis that just haven't that don't have an evidence base with zoos or with dog trainers yet. But the principles are very applicable to what we do. And so, for example, we've used trial-based functional assessment, which is trial-based functional analysis, which is a briefer version of that really systematic method of figuring out the function of a behavior. And that's something that was developed with human learners, and we've used it with animal learners with success. And there are other, other examples like that too. But there's so much in that literature that is really applicable to what we do. And one of the really cool things about it is, you know, I mentioned about the rich to land transition stuff, that it started in the laboratory with animals and then went to human learners and then has kind of come back around to animal learners. There's a lot that's like that in the behavior analysis literature, because before there was applied behavior analysis, there was basic behavior analysis. And a lot of that basic behavior analysis was with animal learners, just in a laboratory setting.
So I know you were part of the speaker team at ChatCon in 2019. When you got there, were you like, yes, people, finally talking to each other? Do we, I'm just joking, but do we need to speak to each other more? Are we not speaking enough?
I think it's very exciting to see the connections that are starting to happen now. And I hope we just continue to build on those. I think ChatCon is a great platform for that. And, you know, I think there are others that I'm seeing too. I mean, I know you've had some behavior analytic researchers on your podcast, and, you know, animal trainers are really starting to get interested in sort of that academic side of operant learning. And I think behavior analytic researchers are also interested in how their work can sort of be informed by the things that animal trainers are doing. So a really great example of that is some work that one of the labs at West Virginia has done for a pretty long time now, but it's an animal lab. They their subjects are pigeons, and they have been looking for a while to try to build a laboratory model of what animal trainers call jackpots. And so what they really wanted to do was take that into the lab, figure out how to set it up, and see if they could figure out like how it works, and, you know, and what under what conditions it works, so that they could, you know, kind of go back the other way, right, and take it back to the applied setting and try to use the laboratory findings to improve what's done in the applied world. And what's interesting about that particular case is that they've tried setting it up lots of different ways, and they haven't been able to get this jackpot effect. So that's sort of interesting in and of itself. But the cool thing about that is that those laboratory researchers have really been informed and inspired by what animal trainers are doing, and trying to take that into the lab and really look more closely at it. And I hope that we can continue those kinds of interplays.
Yeah, and I'm excited about the individuals who are driving that stuff forward. If you haven't heard of ChatCon, shout out to Ryan O, and you can go listen to Ryan O and also Joan Orr on the podcast, ATA Podcast Library, to talk more about setting up and getting ChatCon going. I have so many questions, and I'm also looking at the time, so I'm going to zip up and ask you to share the number 2, 3, 4, and 5 of us.
Okay. So the second one is kind of two sides of a coin. It's the first side is, and these are both misconceptions, but the first side is that scientific ideas are absolute and unchanging. And the second side is that, which is not true, right? Scientific ideas are constantly changing. And in fact, I heard this really great quote recently that I love from Brian Nosek, who's the co-founder and director of the Center for Open Science. And he said, "The reason to trust science is that it doesn't trust itself." So by that, he meant that, you know, scientists are constantly, we're not building a collection of immutable facts, right? We're building ideas that are based on evidence that we're collecting. And, it's science is the best available current evidence. And as we gather more evidence, the best available current evidence changes, right? So it's not true that scientific ideas are absolute and unchanging, but it's also not true that because scientific ideas are tentative and subject to change, that they can't be trusted, right? So that's the other side of it, is that there's this misconception that because science changes, that we can't trust it. So we all hear about this when people talk about, you know, is wine good for you and is chocolate good for you? And it seems like the evidence changes and like we just can't trust it because it changes all the time. And, you know, most recently we could talk about, particularly here in the United States, people not trusting the best available science about health precautions like mask wearing, right? And that, you know, as the best available evidence changes, then, you know, the perception is, well, we just can't trust what these scientists are saying because they just flip-flop all the time. And, they, you know, so that is also a misconception, right? That it is just the best available evidence and it's going to change over time. At the same time, there are lots of sort of lines of scientific evidence that have a huge evidence base that are extremely reliable and are unlikely to have major shifts in them, right? So things like evolutionary theory, things like the basic foundations of operant learning, those are things that have a huge evidence base behind them, and we can be confident that evidence base has a firm foundation, right? However, we as scientists always have to be willing to be wrong. That's part of science. So any of that could change based on new evidence that is collected. So the other thing about this, I'm just going to go on to number three. The other thing about kind of what we learned about science in school that may have led to some misconceptions for us is that we were all sort of taught about the scientific method, right? And so it's led to this misconception that there is this single scientific method that all scientists need to follow. And that's a really oversimplified version of how science works and what scientists do, right? So research actually is a really complex process with lots of different things that happen in lots of different orders. So that's a piece of it. And then directly relevant to animal training, one of the things that a lot of us were taught is that research needs to have a large number of subjects in order to be reliable and generalizable. But the truth is that there is a whole methodology designed to address questions about how individuals learn, or the study of one, as Susan says. So that methodology is called single subject design, and it's the foundation of the research literature on operant learning. So that whole 100-year foundation that we've been talking about, the majority of that is single subject designs. They're not based on group designs with inferential statistics like we all kind of learned about with those large sample sizes. So to really understand how to evaluate research on operant learning, we need to understand the basics of single subject design, which a lot of us were not taught in science class. So the fourth misconception is that science proves ideas. So I often get asked for studies. So people will say, can you send me an article that shows that positive reinforcement is better than punishment? Can you send me an article that shows X, right? And most of the time I have to give a more complicated answer than what they're looking for, because scientific proof is really more something that journalists write about than something that scientists talk about. So science is really built on ideas, and then we gather evidence to support those ideas or to adjust those ideas. And it doesn't really, it's not really about proving or disproving something. It's about gathering that that evidence to help us understand how things work. So that's number four. Number five is, the misconception is that, if an investigation doesn't reach a firm conclusion, then it's useless or it's unpublishable, right? So if a study doesn't have a firm takeaway conclusion, then it's just useless. And again, back to our previous conversation about the value of studies that generate lots of new questions, that's really kind of the answer to this misconception, right? So In scientific articles, you'll actually see in the discussion section, first of all, authors will often discuss sort of alternative ways of explaining their results and alternative things that could have accounted for their results. And that will be part of the basis for future research on those questions. And also when the investigation just generated a lot of new questions, they'll talk about that as well. So it's really just it's a process of inquiry and of of continual learning and questioning. So there you go.
I loved it. Number one, science, the misconception is science is complete. Number two was the coin with two sides, one side being scientific ideas are absolute and unchanging, and the other side being because science changes, we can't change. Did I get that right?
It's because science changes, we can't trust
it. We can't trust it. I don't know. I read that, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Number three is that the misconception is that there is a single scientific method. And you talked about single subject designs there, which I want to learn more about. Number four was science proves ideas. That's a misconception. And the fifth misconception is if a study doesn't have a firm conclusion, it's not worthy. Did I get this right?
Yes.
Woo-hoo. Perfect. And you also said the reason to trust science is because it doesn't trust itself. Who said that again? That's an awesome saying. I want to quote that.
Let me go back to, I don't want to get it wrong. His name is Brian Nosek, and he's the co-founder and director of the Center of Open Science.
So I was thinking back to number three, one of them, anyway, and you were saying that science isn't complete and we have to learn all of these new things, and you shared some really great examples with us, but there is some things like evolution and the basic principles of operant conditioning that have a firm foundation evidence base. So I was just thinking maybe if we're to reframe saying that we are science-based trainers, what might we say? I wrote down here, I am a firm foundation evidence-based trainer. Do you have any other offerings? Like what is a non-cultural fog way to articulate that we are aware of and paying attention to and being fluid with science as an animal trainer, and as someone who's offering services to our community, what might be an accurate way of framing ourselves, of a label that we could give ourselves, or should we not?
I actually really like evidence-based trainer or science-based trainer. I think those are great ways of putting it. I think, to your point, it's really more of a reframing of how we talk about those terms and what we mean when we say, I'm a science-based trainer, I'm an evidence-based trainer, and going from a meaning that focuses on particular things that are known and that are immutable and that we don't have any more to learn about it, and moving towards an understanding that's more about actively learning continually, right? And that's what science is. Science isn't a collection of facts. Science is continual learning and trying to understand how the world works by gathering evidence in really systematic ways. And so if we understand it that way, and we think about, again, evidence-based practice as a verb and science-based training as a verb, then I think that kind of gets closer to what we've been talking about in terms of really connecting with that science and with its staying connected with it as it grows and changes.
Cool. I love that. Thank you. Sadly, we are now going to head towards the end of the episode, though. Could you, for this part, Christy, please take us into the future and share what you want to see happen. And we're probably going to be pulling from various parts of our conversation today, but what you want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training and the applied behavior analysis world.
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to our conversation about continuing to build those connections between the animal training world and the science of operant learning. So again, it's that that living, growing science of operant learning, and building both sides of that connection, meaning, like we talked about before, the animal trainer side of that would be acting as informed consumers and continuing to be curious and to be open to learning and using that research really well in our practice. And then on the research side, again, those researchers conducting practice-inspired research that's really relevant to the practical needs of animal trainers. So that actually has been happening, that practice-inspired research has been happening for a long time with behavior analytic research that's relevant to work with human learners. So for example, there's been a lot of laboratory research set up to model situations that happen in the lives of those learners at school and at home, like what happens, what happens when we have to plan to address a challenging behavior, but that plan is carried out only partially correctly because humans are human and we make mistakes. And then the example about jackpots and modeling jackpots in the lab. So that's an example of a concept that's discussed really frequently by animal trainers, and it's used in a lot of different ways, right? So people say jackpot and they mean lots of different things. And Andy Littal and his colleagues at West Virginia set up these laboratory experiments to try to better understand it. I really, in the next 5 or 10 years, I would really love to see more of both sides of that, right? Of that interplay between trainers and researchers, with trainers really building their capacity to understand the research literature and use it well, and with researchers really continuing to plug in to what animal trainers and animal professionals are doing and how their research can be relevant to that work.
So the animal trainers being good consumers of the literature. I find the word consumer interesting. When you choose to use that word, like how do you, I immediately think of a consumer of products and services that you pay money for. Why do you think, because I've heard it before as well, that word has been chosen. What does it mean? What does it mean to you in your words?
Yeah, I don't love that word either because I think of the same thing you do. And I think that actually in this use, the intention is more on the to be a synonym with digestion, right? Of that kind of consuming. So it's you're taking the research in and using it to your benefit. So that kind of consuming. But yeah, I think that's it's a tricky word, but that's really what it means to me, is that if someone is a good critical consumer of research, then they know enough about the how research works and how research in operant learning specifically works to be able to read a research paper, evaluate it, at least sort of the basics of it, to figure out what questions it was answering, the methods that it was using to answer those questions, and then sort of interpret the results of that in terms of the value for your practice. And, keeping in mind that, and this is one of the, it kind of goes along with some of the misconceptions that we talked about, that no single study is going to answer all of your questions about a particular technique or a particular principle. And in fact, a lot of times it takes multiple studies to answer a single question about a particular technique or a practice. And so when we're thinking about the value of a particular study, we really have to keep that in mind too, that we bite off small chunks with each study and we build on those over time. And we also need replication, right? We need replication in different settings and with different circumstances and things like that. I think a really great illustration of all of this is the recent discussions that have been happening over a study that was published by Clive Wynne and some of his colleagues. And it looked at acquisition of new behaviors using a clicker as a bridge, and I think something else as a bridge, and then no bridge. And the best response that I've seen to some of the discussions that have been going on was Ken Ramirez's blog post about this. So if you haven't seen that, I definitely recommend checking it out. He really summarized well some of the things that we're talking about in terms of, answering the question of what was the purpose of this study? How did they set it up? What does it mean for us? And putting that all in context. I think he did that really well.
Cool. Well, I'll try to remember to link to that in the show notes as well. I love watching Ken's talks about the research that he set up with Match to Sample, and I know he's got some great practical experience in engaging in that process. Hopefully an approximation towards becoming better consumers. And now you explain it like that, it makes complete sense. That didn't even cross my mind, which is interesting. And getting more practice-inspired research is this offering that we talked about earlier that you are collaborating with Dr. Susan Friedman and Behavior Works. Can you just remind everyone listening where they can go to find out more information about that and also to get in touch with yourself if they have any questions or find you online?
Sure. So the course is called How Research Works, and you can find all of the information on it on the Behavior Works website. That's www.behaviorworks.org. And it'll be under Professional Courses on the menu on the left-hand side. And to get in touch with me, I have many email addresses, so if you haven't heard this one and you have a different one, the one you have probably works too. But I'll give you a caa@behaviorworks.org. That's a really easy one.
caa@behaviorworks.org. Hey, wonderful. We will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes as well. Christy, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. We really appreciate everything you do, your life's work, and also for coming and taking time to hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy. It's really appreciated. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.